Well, you know, something wonderful, something unprecedented and expansive is happening when your two-year-old grandson shouts with confidence and conviction for the very first time, "No, Grammy." To be that autonomous and will-filled enough to say no is a sign of our humanity. I promise you that Charlie is getting plenty of practice on our Mondays together. Charlie's response to no also becomes more nuanced when spoken by his father or mother or each of his five grandparents. We all get a slightly different reaction. I tested this theory just last week when he was not really listening to me, telling him to sit down in his high chair. I invoked his father by asking him, "What does your father say when he asks you to sit down?" Oh, the expression on his face. And a slight tear coming down to his eye. Such a different response then. And I assure you, his father is very gentle with him. But he has a very deep voice. The decision to comply or resist depends upon the situation and the relationship. Now, he's only two, but the power and complexity of his no and his yes is undeniable. Spending time with any child or infant is a physical, fully embodied experience. To thrive, they need to be held, rocked, embraced while read to, jiggled and tossed about playfully, and soothed when they cry. They do need to be contained when they insist on standing up in their high chair or climbing on furniture. They need to run and wrestle and know there are limits set and kept well in place. In all of these, yes and no are embodied in human touch and care. The ability to express both yes and no are essential to human growth and survival. I suppose I shouldn't be surprised then to discover that both yes and no can be corrupted. Our consent and the power dynamics in play are important to understand when Charlie responds differently to my no's versus his mother's or his father's. We have to understand power dynamics in order to understand the Me Too movement and our changing perceptions of sexual harassment. I am sure this analysis did not exist when I came of age. In Unitarian Universalist communities, it is spoken of and understood better only in the last 20 or 30 years. So this is a learning curve for men and women in faith communities and for our society as a whole. What was silenced and hidden once is finally being spoken of in some newly open and public ways. How we respond and change because of these revelations seems to be a work in progress still. As clergy, I work in a field that has had to learn to take sexual abuse very seriously and still has a great deal to learn. The clergy abuse revelations of the past few decades have changed our entire religious landscape. Clergy are often well-respected, charismatic figures, looked to as moral teachers and exemplars by their respective communities. Partly because of the level of trust and intimacy in clergy work, the opportunities for abuse abound. Too often, confidentiality and secrecy have gone hand in hand. Here are some of the things that I've learned. First is that consenting adult is a meaningless term when there is a significant power imbalance in the relationship. That means that an intern or assistant or aide is not in a position to give or withhold consent from a powerful politician or a clergy member. There's no such thing as a consenting sexual relationship or encounter between an adult and a child, or an older adult and a teenager. No such thing. Such actions are the worst form of abuse. The recent revelations of the abuse of young athletes by a trusted doctor underline how damaging the abuse of power can be to young lives. Larry Nassar had the trust of the institutions he served. The parents and the young women he preyed on all saw him as a trustworthy, healing, and supportive figure in their lives. With that trust, he took terrible license, and hundreds of girls now carry the scars. When a beloved, a respected figure commits sexual abuse or misconduct, it is incredibly divisive to an entire community. Many will leap to defend the actions of the leader, explain them away, blame the person who's been harassed or abused, or accuse the whistleblower of ulterior motives, particularly if such actions seem at odds with the figure's public statements, positions, and actions. It's hard to believe something that seems so incongruous on the surface of it. That doesn't make it any less true, though. The tendency is often to shove these incidents under the rug, which cuts off the victim's and the community's ability to heal. Even when the perpetrator goes away or is as asked to leave, such silence becomes a form of acquiescence. And it's the silence that is indeed violence in and of itself. Power differentials can further victimize all survivors and empower all abusers of every kind, because it demonstrates the truth that the threatening statement, "Nobody will believe you," and sets a high cost for truth-telling. Some misconduct is obviously more damaging than others. Still, minimizing, ignoring, or denying sexual misconduct empowers all abusers. When victims are isolated and silenced, it tears at the very fabric of community by undermining our trust in one another. Such abuse also undermines our trust in ourselves. When a child who by definition needs love and physical affection to survive is abused, will they trust their own inner sense of right and wrong enough to know it? Even as adults, when we experience an abuse of power, we question our own knowing. We acquiesce to a code of silence that protects the abuser and all the institutions that support them. We, in effect, silence ourselves. Reverend Erica Hewitt published this reflection on her own experience with power differentials as an aspiring minister. She begins with this quote by Martha Stortz: "Every theory of power is implicitly a theory of community." Silence is dynamic. It does things, she says. When silence becomes a living character in our personal narratives, it's often an accomplice to power. When I was a new seminary graduate, still short of the red tape requirements for ministry, one of my mentors, who was married, propositioned me over a period of several weeks. Today, over a decade later, I am less stunned by his violation of boundaries and decency than I am by how little I trusted my own sense of truth about what was happening. Had he been so inclined or provoked, this minister could have uprooted the tender sapling of my ministry. His power was an entrenched magnetic force, what theologian Mary Shortz names power over, which coupled with my doubt coerced me into silence. What does silence gain us? What does silence cost? When I finally asked a female mentor for help, Katie took mercifully swift action, shielding me from retribution. Hers was a life-giving power with. And yet, beyond the rungs of her power, the system doggedly protected itself. The perpetrator rose in prominence. That silence, that larger silence, the sun around which the other planets of silence revolved, broke faith with me and with the truth. This notion of giving our consent, our own yes or no, to touch is a powerful one. This newer understanding of power dynamics also places responsibility upon the asker to consider if they should even ask at all. It's a uniquely grown-up thing to do, to monitor your own desires and impulses and your power in a relationship, and set your own boundaries for the benefit of those who are subordinate. While this is the goal, we know that not all human beings are capable of keeping appropriate boundaries. Sometimes the community has to step in and do it for them. Protecting vulnerable populations is far too important. As a congregation here, we have safe congregation policies and procedures. We have covenants and policies and procedures to address disruptive behaviors. Most importantly, we hold one another accountable to a high standard of conduct and an understanding that power dynamics and consent really do matter. In our whole lives, our children and youth are given the tools to have healthy relationships when they are ready. They learn about the media and internet and the ways it can be abused. They learn to recognize bullies and what the responsibilities of bystanders are. Yay, Logan, right? Unfortunately, we can never protect our children from all the possible abuses out there. It breaks my heart to think of our children and youth learning about sexuality from pornography that belittles and demeans women and girls especially. What we can do and have been doing for over 40 years now is equip our children and youth with the facts and the skills to navigate their feelings in a healthy manner. With these in hand, a child may experience one negative encounter, but it's much less likely to be repeated, to be buried in shame and silence. Fresh air and sunshine will work its magic. The wound can heal because a child will be heard and be believed. The perpetrator must be removed from any possibility of doing harm again. And we hope and pray that child can return to being a child again. As Michelle shared her and Logan's story as it unfolded these past few weeks, I am newly grateful for our OWL program and for this congregation's commitment to it. I know it changes far more lives than we can ever know or count. The values we teach of respect for self and others, of mutual empowerment and consent, and the power of knowledge rather than fear, changes the very shape and texture of a life, of many lives lived with love that carries each and all. This Unitarian Universalist faith is not neutral on these matters. As we center ourselves around our values and relationships, it may at times be uncomfortable. But we center ourselves around principles and a tradition that calls us into what it is to be more beautifully human. Just as long as I have breath, I will honor yes and no. It is hard work, and it's only done when we're together in community. The measure of this community is this love. It's fierce, it's listening. As Jordine Nelson Long reminds us, this love attends to dynamics of power, how power is flowing, where it's centered, who it silences, and who it's benefiting. Because of this practice, we can assess at any point how we're doing in our work by looking at the margins, looking at the quiet ones, the silenced ones. Does our faith, does our listening, does our love uplift the least of these? My Charlie will, I hope, grow up to know the power of his yes and no. As for every child, I pray that they feel respected and so learn to respect themselves and others. I pray that they know true love in every way possible and at every age. I pray that playground heroes know that we see them and support them. I pray for us all that a world of justice, mercy, and compassion for the least of these is created and celebrated today on our